For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and in today's show, Dave Steele describes how writing poetry has enabled him to create a place where he and others can gain insight into sight loss.
Though my retinas are dying, my mind's vision has increased. Each day I'm making memories for long after sight has ceased.
Liz Pichon tells us all about the brilliant world of her preteen creation, Tom Gates.
I actually went out and bought a school exercise book and then sat down and imagined that it was actually Tom who was writing in the book.
A young listener sends me back to the Stone Age with his educating red suggestion.
Which basically just rips up everything in its path.
And there's another chance to hear two of the poems that shone in last year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Four years ago, Dave Steele's life changed dramatically when he was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa and then registered blind. As we'll hear, what followed could have and nearly did overwhelm him. Instead, it inspired him to write. And the poetry he's created has been changing the lives of those with RP and their families worldwide ever since. He's just published the third volume of Stand By Me, RP, and he joined me down the line from his home in Manchester to tell me more. Dave Steele, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Where did the title for the three volumes of poetry come from, Dave?
It came from a song. The way the idea to start to write the poems, or the way it all sort of came about, was when I was first diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa just about 4 years ago, after the initial period of struggling to sort of come to terms with it, my sister, who lives in San Francisco, who also has RP, advised me to seek information and speak to people, you know, going through a sort of similar experience on a lot of the support groups on Facebook. And through that, I got speaking to some people in my area and was asked to go and sing at an event for people with RP and Usher syndrome, which is deafblindness, at an event in Newcastle. Because I worked as a singer for years beforehand. I used to tour holiday parks and cruise ships and sort of tour around as a professional singer when I was able to sort of drive myself around before I started losing my sight. And the night before going to the event, I was sat in bed with my wife, going over songs and ideas of songs to do for the event. And I thought it'd be a really good idea if I could take a song that everyone knows and change the words to make it a little bit more, you know, more personal, a bit more of a response. So I chose the song Stand By Me by Benny King because I liked the opening about where, when the light is gone and the night is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. I thought that was a great sort of opening, you know, to sort of describe sort of night blindness. And I changed the lyrics in about 20 minutes. I rewrote the whole song, did two additional verses for the song, recorded it, or performed it at the event the following day, recorded it at a friend's house and put a video out on YouTube about a week later. And it started to go viral. And I named the song Stand By Me RP. And I started to get messages from people all over the world saying, you know, what, you know, it made them cry and, you know, it sort of spoke for how they felt. And the response I got was amazing. So that was where I then all of a sudden started to write poetry, because poetry to me is the same as lyrics for songs. It's being able to convey a message in the musical or poetic form that sort of sticks and, you know, resonates like, you know, few other things can do. Plenty of people can sort of do talks and try and raise awareness by speaking, but having it in a sort of poem form or song form is a really unique way of being able to sort of touch the heart and stir, you know, emotions like, you know, like few things can.
That is what I love about your poetry. It is remarkably accessible. There's a lot of snobbery about poetry. A lot of it can feel very inaccessible and English graduate-y. Your poems just speak to the reader.
I think it's a real sort of it seems to be a real trend at the moment. Poetry has made a real big comeback, and poetry is, as many sort of modern day poets that have sort of come to the forefront now, is for the masses. People from my area, from Manchester, Tony Walsh, you may remember, did the speech after the Ariana Grande terrorist attack at the concert at the Manchester Town Hall, where he recited the poem "This Is the Place," which when I saw it just literally blew my mind. And you know, speaking to the masses, poetry that is very simple, that people can understand, that you know, stirs those sort of emotions. It is really on trend at the moment, and you know, it's a great way for me at that time, because I was suffering with anxiety and depression and really struggling to come to terms with such a rapid loss of vision which I had, that I needed some sort of outlet, and as well as being able to help other people through the things that I was saying in the poetry, it helped me. It gave me a purpose, because that was the one thing that sight loss took from me right at the beginning. You know, the people talk about, you know, taking your independence, your confidence, your pride, and all this sort of things. But it actually took my purpose, because everything that I'd done before involved me driving a car. And when I was told that I'd never do that again, I felt like, okay, what am I going to do now? What's the next thing for me? And it was when I hit my lowest that all of a sudden I found the words. So once I started writing, I just couldn't stop, to the point where, you know, 4 years on, I've written over 500 poems, and you know, I look at them now and I still don't know where they come from.
Well, I think you answer that question, you know, what do blind people do, very emphatically with your three volumes of poetry. And I think for a lot of us who've lost our sight, that is the first question that you ask. You know, what do I do with this new identity?
Yeah, you know, as I said, for me, it seemed to come at the lowest sort of time for me. You know, I really didn't have a clue what, I mean, just to put you in the picture, what happened was, you know, everything that I'd done relied on me sort of getting about myself. At the time when I was diagnosed with RP just over 4 years ago, I was at a sort of beginning of a new cycle in my life. I just proposed to my partner Amy, who's now my wife. I proposed on the Christmas Day of 2014, and I was actually diagnosed in the April of that year. We were due to get married on the New Year's Eve of 2013. Christmas Day I proposed. Get me confused there, she'd kill me for that. Anyway, but yeah, we'd just had a baby. My son, our youngest, was only about 8 months old. And, you know, we struggled big time financially. We joined the queue, like a lot of people do, to try and get the support out there. And things like personal independence payment, which there was a 9-month waiting list for. And, you know, it got to the point where, you know, we fell behind with bills. We were struggling to get the help. My vision was declining more rapidly. Stress was adding to that. I wasn't coping with everything that was going on. I was feeling guilty because of the financial pressure that my family was being put under. We got to the point where, you know, we actually had to take food parcels in order to feed our kids because we couldn't get the help out there. And at that point, it was almost like these words started to come from nowhere. And all of a sudden, I had a purpose again. My confidence started to rebuild. And from that point on, I started dedicating my time to helping others. And the more people I helped, the more it helped me. And it's got me to a point now where, you know, I do this. This is what I dedicate my life to now. I've got one of the biggest retinitis pigmentosa support pages on Facebook in the world. And I speak to people every day that are newly diagnosed, or people that are sort of going through rough times with struggling to come to terms with sight loss and all the things that go with it, like the misconceptions. And I try to tell those stories within my poetry. And if I can do that going forward for more people, then, you know, that gives me a point, which is, as you've already said, is what a lot of people with sight loss, you know, look for when they initially get that diagnosis and think, okay, what am I going to do next?
And I think that comes through very strongly in your poetry, the misconceptions that people have, the fact that people do, in the nicest way, need to be educated in what RP, what Usher syndrome means, and how they can understand us, how we can understand it ourselves.
Yeah, it's common though. I mean, we made those mistakes ourselves. I mean, I think we're all sort of guilty of it. Before, you know, I got involved in the blind community, and you know, I sort of had the same sort of opinions. I didn't know. And, you know, there isn't a lot of awareness out there. But, you know, one of the biggest things that I found is that, you know, when you look at a lot of the adverts that are out there for different charities and organisations, the stereotypical, you know, third person, or what people think a stereotypical blind person should look like, is what they portray, because it's easy for the audiences to sort of understand. But, you know, 90-odd% of people, you know, with vision loss have some sort of useful vision. It's not all black and white, you know. And even like with guide dogs as well, you know, I've had my guide dog Christopher, who I've had actually 2 years today since we came home on our training course from guide dog headquarters. You know, a lot of people think that guide dogs know the way to the shops like there's some sort of canine sat nav. and it's not the case, you know. They think, you know, that's what they think. They think, you know, that the guide dog sort of learns routes and takes the blind person there, when it's not the case of that at all. So there's a lot of misconceptions out there, and the more that can be changed in an easy way for people to understand, you know, for example, songs or poetry, which is what I try to do, you know, the more people will not be held back by misconceptions, because, as you know yourself, a lot of people within the blind community are scared at coming out almost, or getting the help they need to, you know, apply for a guide dog or use a cane or win back their independence in any sort of way using mobility aids. They're actually scared of actually taking that leap because of the misconceptions. It's those, you know, misunderstandings and the things of, for example, when I travel about, I go down to London often when I perform. I still work as a singer. I do gigs down there every so often. And when I have assistance booked at the train stations to help me on and off each train and the tubes and stuff like that, and I'll be on there with my cane and I'll sit down. Then as soon as the train gets going, I'll take my phone out and I'll be on Facebook, and, you know, and people sort of go, oh, hang on a second, what's that about? And that's down to, you know, a lack of education and lack of misconception, because people think it's either you can't see at all or you can see just fine. And well, it's not a case of that.
That's where blindness is actually such, or the word blind is such a misleading word. People just assume
Absolutely.
That it's on or off. It's not, you know, sight loss is a far more open to interpretation term. But yes, that awful moment of sitting on the tube and being looked at as a fraud because you're actually using a phone is, I think we've all suffered it. And it does take education. And it actually just takes us using our voices. Now, I believe that you've got a poem that you would like to read out loud on the show.
Yeah, this one, I performed this at Christmas at a big event in Manchester, at Manchester Cathedral for Henshaws, which I'm now an ambassador for, a carols by candlelight service. This one's called The Stranger. Today, a stranger asked me, what has blindness done to me? Has it limited the plans I've made or the things I hope would be? Has it forced me now to settle on a life that's second best? Has it made me give up lots of things since I failed the blindness test? Do I still have aspirations, special places, dreams to go? Is there any point in beauty if the eyes won't work to show? But my answer came so quickly, not a thought considered twice. I am happy for this blindness, for the way it's changed my life. It has taught me what's important, shown me who my real friends are, and I wouldn't change the things I've learned just to get back in my car. I have met amazing people since this RP took my sight. We share in common struggles, joined together through this plight. Though my retinas are dying, my mind's vision has increased. Each day I'm making memories for long after sight has ceased. So never offer pity for the broken sense I've lost, because I feel I have gained more than the price that blindness cost.
That's beautiful. Thanks, Dave. And I think you speak for a very large number of us who maybe don't have the words that you do. What I love about what you are doing and the poems that you write is that you're actually creating a legacy that isn't just passing on faulty genes to our kids. You're actually creating something that is far more positive than that.
Massive, massively important for me, that is, because I've got I've got two children and two stepsons, so four children altogether and a guide dog. And my youngest son is four, Austin, and I've got a 10-year-old daughter who lives by previous relationship, lives in Glasgow, called Ellie. And obviously, with the particular type of RP that I have, which is autosomal dominant, which means there's a clear trace through my family, and there's a one in two chance every time that we could get it. Now, with autosomal dominant, it generally doesn't sort of present itself until later in life, sort of first stages, could be early 20s, where you go from sort of struggling from light to dark places. Very sort of symptoms that are quite unnoticeable. You could go and miss them, as I did in life. You know, you could just sort of put them to other things. And so there's no way of us being able to really know, you know, whether they've got that until they're older. And that's probably, for me, you know, one of the hardest things is looking at the kids. But it also, at the same time, spurs me on to show them all the things that they can do in life and show them all the things they can achieve. And despite the limitations, the natural limitations of having a very limited vision, they can still do amazing things. And, I want to make sure that I leave that legacy for them. And, you know, my last book, which just came out last week, the first page is dedicated to all my children. And I've written, you know, several poems in there that are for them. Those are the ones that tend to sort of be a little bit more emotional. Well, when I read them to my wife after I've just written them, if I make her cry instantly, I know it's a good one. But yeah, I'm very proud of that for them, and it's what spurs me on.
And you've made the books not only accessible by not only having them printed in large print, but also on lovely paper. And I believe there are plans for an audio version.
Yeah, I've been trying to do it for the last couple of years. As I said, you know, the series, the RP series is finished now. I've done three books, and that's it finished. But I'm doing a best of Stand By Me RP audio book, which I've been trying to do for the last couple of years, but I have to fund all this myself, so it's quite an expensive process, and you know, we don't exactly we're still struggling, you know, as we are. The book itself, the audio book, I'm in the process of just finishing that at the moment, and it will be released over the next couple of weeks. So I've been lucky enough. Henshaws, as I said, who I've just joined with to be an ambassador, I'm actually doing it in conjunction with them. So I'm recording it at their head office at the moment, and I'm going to be doing profits to the charity as well from the book. So it all goes to a good cause, especially, you know, being from Manchester in the Northwest, they support a lot of people with sight loss in the Northwest here, and a range of other disabilities as well. So being able to get my words out to more people and also help the charity at the same time is an amazing thing for me to be able to do. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that coming out, and but then obviously the poems are completely accessible for everyone. It's going to be out on iTunes, and the reason for that is most audiobooks, when you actually go to upload them and record them on these sites, what they tend to do is they only allow you to record an introduction and then like the bulk of the book in one long recording. Now, with it being poetry, most people want to sort of listen to it almost like an album. So that's why I've gone down the iTunes route, so they can download the whole, you know, Stand By Me RP best of as one album, or they can actually download individual poems, you know, that might be the favourites. And it's a lot easier for them to sort of be able to skip across and stuff like that and listen to it, you know, like music. After that, the next big thing, which I'm hoping to do with R&IB, I've spoke to a few people, which is a massive project I'm working on at the moment. I've been working on it on the back burner for the last, about a year, is I'm going to be doing a Stand By Me RP album. Now, with this, I've not really spoke about this very often, but I'll give you the scoop. Basically, what I'm doing is every single poem that I've wrote, because my favourite poems or poets are all lyricists, they all come from my love of music, and all the poems that I've written have all been intended to be turned into songs one day. So what I'm doing is I've got different visually impaired musicians from all over the world turning my poems from the Stand By Me RP books into songs of different styles. So we've got some country, we've got some opera, we've got some rock, we've got rap, we've got all sorts. And I've got different musicians I've got some from the UK, a lot of American, some pretty big people as well in America that are in the process of recording their tracks. And then we're going to do that on iTunes as a charity album, which is going to be released probably by the time it's done, it's going to be the tail end of this year or beginning of next year, and that'll be split between, hopefully, I was looking at doing RNIB and a charity in the States, possibly Foundation Fighting Blindness in America, who do great work into research for the cures, you know, in the likes of RP and Usher syndrome as well. So, yeah, that's another big project we've got coming up, so that should be pretty exciting, hearing the songs being turned into music, which, as I said, it's all the poems being turned into music, which is, you know, from the start what they've been intended to do.
Well, that's great news, not least because one of the problems that many of us with sight loss face is knowing what to ask for Christmas and birthdays. So I think you sorted me out. Dave Still, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and a personal thanks for helping me to articulate to my loved ones what RP means.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks to Dave Still. All three versions of Stand By Me, RP, are available in large print and as ebooks from Amazon, with, as we've heard, the audiobook collection coming soon. And we'll be hearing more from Dave at the end of the show.
The TED Radio Hour.
Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
The gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio.
Every Thursday at 1 p.m. or 8 p.m. and Saturday at noon.
Get all the latest news and more for people with sight loss by connecting with RNIB on Facebook and Twitter. Support us on social media for all sorts of extras. And it's a great way of networking with like-minded people. Search for RNIB on Facebook and follow us now on @RNIB. Follow us and find out more about the UK's leading sight loss charity and feel part of the RNIB family.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come on this week's show, I'll be taking a prehistoric walk on the wild side with Wolf Brother. And there's more proof of the power of poetry from last year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. But before that, Tom Gates is a hugely successful character among the pre-teen audience. His creator, author Liz Pichon, joined Robert Kirkwood to talk about messy bedrooms and late homework. First, here's a clip read by Ryan Watson.
Even though I live 4 minutes away from my school, I'm often late. This is usually because me and Derek, my best mate and next-door neighbour, chat a bit. Okay, a lot, on the way. Sometimes it's because we get distracted by delicious fruit chews and caramel wafers at the shop. Occasionally, it's because I've had loads of very important things to do. For instance, this is what I did this morning, my first day back at school. Woke up, listened to music, played my guitar, rolled out of bed, slowly, looked for socks, looked for clothes, played some more guitar, realised I hadn't done my holiday reading homework, panicked, thought of good excuse for lack of homework, phew, annoyed my sister Delia, which I admit did take up a very large chunk of the morning. Time well spent, though. Hid Delia's sunglasses, took my comic into the bathroom to read, while Delia waited outside. When Mum shouts, "Tom, you're late for school!" Run past Delia, who's still waiting outside the bathroom and quite cross now. Ignore her sisterly love. Creep! Save precious time by not brushing hair, not brushing teeth for very long, not kissing Mum goodbye. Too old for that kind of thing. Eat the last piece of toast, then grab my packed lunch and my bike. Shout bye to anyone who can hear me. Then bike to school in about 2 minutes flat, which is a new Tom Gates world record. And this is the really good bit. Amy Porter has just arrived too. I am so pleased to see her after the holidays. I smile in what I think is a nice, friendly, cheery way. Amy is not impressed. She looks at me like I'm weird. I'm not.
Ryan Watson reading from The Brilliant World of Tom Gates by Liz Pichon. That's the one available from RNIB. The ones that are available commercially are read by Rupert Grint. And I'm now joined by Liz Pichon. Liz, first of all, where did Tom Gates come from?
Well, Tom originally was an idea for a picture book. So that was, I kind of wanted to do a book where I had lots of drawings, and I imagined it was going to be, when children first go to reception class, they have to do something about their family and their friends and their pets, and, they do an All About Me book. And that was the original idea for it. And what often happens sometimes in publishing, or if you do an idea, it gets sent out to the publishers and they either say, nope, that's not for us, or, yeah, we quite like it, but there's not enough of a story there. And that's what happened to me. So I sort of rewrote it about two or three times. And then eventually I actually went out and bought a school exercise book and then sat down and imagined that it was actually Tom who was writing in the book, and he was writing about a camping trip and of all the terrible things that went wrong on his camping trip. And we had lots of comments from his teacher in there. So that's how it... There's a very long-winded answer to say. That's how it came about.
Have you had some bad camping experiences yourself?
Oh, I've got lots of friends that go camping and they always try and persuade me. I've had a couple of sort of camping trips. I've sort of been to festivals and things when I was younger. But it's never really been for me. I always think, it's that thing where... I think people that go and they have all the equipment and everything, then it's not too bad. But I always think to myself, God, by the time you've bought all the equipment and everything, I'd rather stay somewhere warm and dry.
Now, 2,000 Tom Gates books in the UK alone, did you expect it to become such a phenomenon?
Yeah, it's 2 million. It's over 2 million.
What did I say?
You said 2,000.
2,000, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, honestly, higher.
Now, over two books in the UK... Now, over 2 million books in the UK alone, did you expect it to become such a phenomenon?
I absolutely didn't, no. I mean, it's been incredible. When the first book came out, it was in 2011. It came out in April 2011. And, you really want it to do well and you really want people to like it and to, to enjoy it. But the thrill of seeing it in a bookshop was fantastic. That was good enough for me. I was like, great, I can actually see it. I can go into a bookshop and look at it. And then as it's gradually sort of grown with every book, and now it's in 41 different languages. And I'm about to go on Saturday. I'm going off to New Zealand and Australia, and it's sold over 1 million copies just in Australia, and quite a few, it's in Germany and lots of different places. So yeah, the answer to your question, it is incredible, and I didn't ever expect it, but I'm enjoying every minute of it.
Is it weird seeing your books translated into another language?
Do you know, I love it. I absolutely love it. I love getting the copies. So far, all of them have kept the design and the style, so they all really look like Tom Gates books. There might be the odd word here and there that's changed, but they look very much like identifiably Tom Gates, and it's fantastic. Now I'm just thrilled that they're in so many languages.
Now, one thing we don't get if we're listening to the audio versions through RNIB libraries are the illustrations. Give us a flavour of them. How would you describe them?
Well, they're very sort of, if you imagine Tom as a character, he's very enthusiastic and very sort of lively. And I say he's not really naughty, he's just a little bit pesky. So the illustrations are kind of, they're black and white. They're sort of single sort of lines, and they're very, he draws his families, he creates monsters, he draws sort of stars and fish and bugs and creatures, and he uses lots of different bits of paper. And in this particular book, he uses lots of sticky notes as well, which are like post-it notes, so he's drawing all over those. So it's very sort of vibrant.
And the Rupert Grint audio versions, they're vibrant in an audio sort of way because they're full of little sound effects and things like
that. Yeah, no, they're great. I was so pleased that he agreed to do them, because I really wanted somebody who had, lots of character as well, that wasn't so much like an actor, that kind of, but actually had, and the fact that he's done, the Harry Potter and the kids would know him and everything. So no, I was absolutely delighted by that. But it is quite tricky because the books are very visual. I've got lots of drawings and doodles on every page. So the fact that they've managed to capture the books on audio is brilliant.
Do you think it changes the reading experience, listening rather than reading?
I don't know. I mean, somebody would have to really tell me about that and whether they enjoy it or not. And I think if it's done, that's one of the things when my kids were little, that sometimes we'd get a favourite picture book, and if there was an audio book that went with it, then we'd get that as well. And, if they were very tired or something, I'd put that on so they could listen to the audio book as well. It was something I always loved when I was a kid as well. I can still remember my mum putting on Peter and the Wolf with just the music and being absolutely terrified. sort of hiding behind the sofa. So I think, you know, if the books are done well, then just the quality of the sound and the stories can really sort of bring it to life. So,
and not just an actual audio version. I mean, they're great for being read by an adult to a child.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another thing. You know, adults tell me as well that they don't mind actually reading. You know, there's always that thing sometimes, you know, if your kids are really keen on some book and they bring it to them and go, can we read this? And your heart just goes, okay. But I always try and put little things in there as well so that the adults will recognise, you know, the sort of family traits that go on, the sort of things that mums say as well. There's quite a lot about plastic containers in this book. And my editor actually asked me, she wasn't quite sure about the plastic containers. And it's always this thing that when you go on holiday, there's always something that your mum, or, you know, I used to do, that you'd always bring, like, bring the plastic containers, you know, bring the plastic bags. You never know how useful they're going to be. So it's a kind of mum thing, or, you know, something that your dad might do as well.
Now, you're here to tell us about the 10th book in the series. What can we expect from this one?
Well, the 10th book, I can't believe I'm saying that. The 10th book is called Super Good Skills, Almost. So it's got lots of pages as well, which are sort of, you know, activity pages in there as well. But it's mainly about Tom. It's the end of term. So Mr. Fullerman, his teacher, is a bit weary, as teachers get, quite rightly so, towards the end of term. But Tom is slightly distracted because he's thinking about his holiday. So he's going on holiday, and this year they're not going camping. They're going to stay in what's called a mobile villa. And he's seen pictures of it, and he's very excited. And it's just nice to get away for a few days. But then he discovers that Delia is being allowed to bring a friend, because she's a grumpy teenager, and the parents were saying that you can't stay at home on your own. And the only way they could persuade her to come with them is if she was allowed to bring a friend. And Tom's not that happy about it. And he's won these huge packet of sort of sticky notes in the school end of term school raffle. So he's finding all kinds of fun things to do with his sticky notes, like putting rude messages on the back of his sister. Not that I'm encouraging children to do that, obviously.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, will there be an 11th book?
There will be, yeah. In fact, I've already started writing it. Well, I've started thinking of the ideas anyway. I've got a whole page. When I first write a book, I come up with what I call, it's like a little story map. It's almost, and so I jot down like individual ideas and try and work out a way that the story is going to flow. And I've got all those ideas down on a piece of paper in my bag, and I'm going to have a nice chat with my editor about it later today.
Is that a good tip for someone who maybe wants to start writing, map out the story first?
Yeah. Well, you can do. Or, you know, one of the ways that I started writing Tom was I didn't think of the whole story. I used to think of like little individual scenarios. So it might be Tom goes to the dentist. You know, Tom has a school photo. So, and then you ask yourself questions about what would happen if he had a school photo. Well, of course, he's eaten lots of toast and he's late, so his hair's messy, he's got toast crumbs all over him, and he takes a terrible picture. And so, you know, you write down one thing like that, and then it suddenly spurs all these different ideas. And then I just write them down individually and then gradually put them in different orders and bring them together. And then you might, when you're actually writing the book, sometimes you might come up with something else and you think, oh, that would be funny. Well, that would be better stories. You change it as you go along, but it's a really good basis of how to start something. So you're not looking at a blank piece of paper and going, what shall I do? Where shall I start?
Now, if we've inspired a listener to go out and get a hold of the book, where can they go?
Well, they can go to any bookshops that are around, and you can go you can get them online as well. And I said, you can't, you know, they're absolutely everywhere at the moment, and if they aren't, you might find me in a bookshop sort of moving the books around as well, moving the audio books around, making sure that everyone can see them.
And if someone wants to find out more about you, do you have a website?
I do, yeah. So it's lizpichon.com. And, you know, if I'm going on tour as well, then there'll be information on there. And there's also a competition I think the publishers are running called, it's a Super Good Skills Almost. So we're trying to find out what your super good skill is. So there's lots of information, and there'll be a link on my website, or you can go to the Scholastic website as well.
Finally, what's your super good skill?
Oh, you know, well, I've got very peculiar bendy thumbs as well, which I do demonstrate. You know, I can actually bend my thumbs back. You know, I didn't realise it was such a freaky thing to do, but when I've done it, everyone in the office has sort of looked at me and went, oh, that's horrible. And I have demonstrated today how I can play a tune on my face which was incredibly underwhelming from everybody by the expression. So yeah, those are some of my slightly sad super good scales.
I'm trying to bend my thumb back right now and I think I've hurt myself. So
I know.
On that note, I'll say Liz Pichon, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Liz Pichon. Many of her books are available from the RNIB Library in a range of accessible formats, including The Brilliant World of Tom Gates, which is TB20386. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up, a pair of poems marking very different anniversaries, and the books of Dave Steele's life. But before that, as you know, here at Read On, we love to hear about the books that you're enjoying. You can email us via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk, or contact producer Robert Kirkwood via Twitter @talking_books. One younger listener who did so is 10-year-old Callum, who gave me the following Educating Red suggestion.
The quest is to defeat the bear, which is actually possessed by a demon. So that's why it's acting so unnaturally. And it basically makes it super-powered. And they have a time limit. So when the Auroch moon, I'm pretty sure it's called, rises, that's when demons are strongest. They will become unstoppable.
Well, I have a long journey ahead of me next weekend, so I shall take Wolf Brother by Michelle Paver, is it?
Yes, Michelle Paver.
I shall take a copy of that with me on my iPod, and I shall look forward to listening to it.
That was a week ago. And true to my word, I went to the RNIB Library and borrowed the first book in the Chronicles of Ancient Darkness series by Michelle Paver, Wolf Brother. As Torak's father lies dying, having been savaged by a demon bear, he makes his 12-year-old son swear an oath. He must find the sacred mountain before the bear becomes all-powerful, otherwise the forest and all who live in it will perish. Torak has grown up in the forest, but far from the other clans of Stone Age people, each of which have adopted a different animal as their clan guardian. Torak belongs to the wolf clan, and as he flees the homicidal bear, he adopts an orphaned wolf cub as his companion. Alone, injured and terrified, they must fend for themselves and live off the land, as they journey north to fulfil Torak's quest.
He sat down again. "You've got to find the Mountain of the World Spirit within the next moon," he told himself. "That's what Far said. When the red eye is highest, that's when demons are strongest. You know this." "Yes, I do know it," thought Torak. "I know about the red eye. I've seen it." Every autumn, the great bull Auroch, the most powerful demon in the other world, escapes into the night sky. At first, he has his head down, pawing the earth, so that only the starry gleam of his shoulder can be seen. But as winter comes on, he rises and grows stronger. That's when you see his glittering horns and his bloodshot red eye, the red star of winter. And in the moon of Red Willow, he rides highest and evil is strongest. That's when the demons walk. That's when the bear will be invincible. Glancing up through the branches, Torak saw the cold glint of stars. On the eastern horizon, just above the distant blackness of the high mountains, he found it. The starry shoulder of the great Auroch. It was now the end of the moon of roaring stags. In the next moon, the Blackthorn moon, the red eye would appear, and the power of the bear would grow stronger. By the moon of Red Willow, it would be invincible. "Head north," Far had said. "Many day walks." Torak didn't want to go further north. That would take him out of the small patch of the forest that he knew and into the unknown. And yet, Far must have believed that he stood a chance or he wouldn't have made him swear.
The boy and the wolf are able to communicate with each other, and Wolf acts as Torak's guide through a forest devastated by the marauding bear. But they're captured by the Raven clan, A meeting of the clans is called, at which Torak discovers that his destiny is not his own. His father told him nothing about the events surrounding his birth, or of the prophecy of the Listener. As the clans debate whether to sacrifice Torak to the demon bear, time is running out. The phase of the moon when the demon bear will become invincible is approaching fast. Only Torak, aided by Wolf and a young female hunter named Wren, can save the forest and its inhabitants from annihilation. Wolf Brother was something of a first for me. I can't remember ever having read a book that was set 6,000 years ago. It's a mark of just how well written and researched it is that I found myself gripped by the plot from the outset. It throws the reader straight into the action. The skills required of the hunter-gatherer and the way primitive man made and used tools and coexisted with the natural world around him is deftly woven into the storyline. It's a great mix of action-packed entertainment and fact-filled anthropology.
It took Torak 2 full days to butcher the carcass. He had made the buck a promise, and he had to keep it by not wasting a thing. That was the age-old pact between the hunters and the world spirit. Hunters must treat prey with respect, and, in return, the spirit would send more prey. It was a daunting task. It takes many summers of practice to use prey well. Torak didn't make a very good job of it, but he did his best. First, he slit the deer's belly and cut a slip of the liver for the clan guardian. The rest of the liver he cut into strips and set to dry. Then he relented and cut off a bit for Wolf, who slurped it up. Next, Torak skinned the carcass, scraping the hide clean of flesh with his antler scraper. He washed the hide in water mixed with crumbled oak bark to loosen the hairs, then stretched it between 2 saplings, well out of Wolf's leaping range. Then he scraped off the hairs, inexpertly making several holes, and softened the hide by rubbing it with mashed deer brain. After a final round of soaking and drying, he had a reasonable skin of rawhide for rope and fishing lines. While the hide was drying, he cut the meat into thin strips and hung them over a smoky birchwood fire. When they were dry, he pounded them between 2 stones to make them thinner, then rolled them into small, tight bundles. The meat was delicious. One little piece would last him half a day. The innards he washed, soaked in oak bark water, and draped over a juniper bush to dry. The stomach would make a water skin, the bladder a spare tinder pouch, the guts would store nuts. The lungs were Wolf's share, although not yet. Torak would chew them at day meals and night meals, then spit them out for the cub. But, as he had no cooking skin for making glue, he let Wolf have the hooves straight away. The cub played with them tirelessly before crunching them to bits.
This left me far more open to accept the fantasy elements of the tale. It's a world of magic and demons. The clans believe that all living things have souls that must be respected and appeased. Again, Paver's research and deft storytelling make this seem perfectly natural, by showing just how closely the hunter-gatherers' lives are intertwined with their habitat. Also, though I've never been a great fan of books that feature animals with human characteristics, I found myself so caught up with the story that in this case it didn't bother me. By alternating between Torak's and Wolf's points of view, Paver highlights just how differently human and Wolf see the same events. Wolf very much has his own voice, which makes his character more three-dimensional, and underlines how precarious Torak's position as hero is. It also provides much of the book's humour, as when Wolf calls fire the bright beast that bites hot. If I'm wearing my cynical adult's hat, I'd have to admit that this is a very well-worn story in a new guise. It's Lord of the Rings or Star Wars set in the Stone Age. However, I'm not the target audience, and this is not a lazily written book. Anyone reading Wolf Brother will come away knowing a lot more about Stone Age man and hunter-gatherer tribes. And it's not just a book for boys. Wren is a practical and brave female counterpoint to Torak's adolescent male energy. So thanks, Callum, for a gripping, entertaining and very educative Educating Red suggestion.
The version of Wolf Brother by Michelle Paver that I downloaded from the RNIB library is brilliantly read by David Thorpe and is TB14202. The version Callum loves, read by Sir Ian McKellen, is available commercially. Do you have a book that you feel would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair, that's all one word, at rnib.org.uk. We'd love you to tell us all about it. Now, before we return to Dave Steele for the books of his life, here's another chance to hear two of the runners-up in the poetry section of last year's creative writing competition. The theme was anniversaries, and entries needed to be a maximum of 30 lines long. But otherwise, our budding bards were encouraged to explore their creativity. Michael Law did just that in verse that Judge Emily Berry, an award-winning poet herself, described as a very atmospheric poem with imagery which reflects on the seasons of life without flinching from its dark side.
Anniversary by Michael Law. Winter found you, they say, on the convent steps, swaddled in white, cocooned in comfort. A warm wicker basket blanketed in snow, beyond which Sister Mary's kindly spectacles shone above ruddy cheeks, glowing like coal fires. Spring stripped you, but wool next the skin remained the rule, till you could break loose and lithe in running first over the hurdles, licked by the cool breeze you loved, tasting the tang, the April sun flecking the empty athletics ground with its new minting. In summer you belly flopped in the swimming hole with friends, warming your naked puppy fat together on grassy verges, watching the ants in sheltering shafts of green, rolling again together like bubbling laughter into the brown water. But autumn caught you on a cold hook of age, the grey leaf like a hand over your heart. You reached for clothes again at the first touch, remembering the glowing coal fire cheeks, wool next the skin. They turned to tatters as you clawed at them. All that remained was last year's comforter, grown thin and patched to tuck round your hoarse throat. The winter fields lie bled and black, waiting for snow again. Half deaf now, torn, gashed for sightless eyes, the wind sings sharp in your crossed sticks. You clap your wooden hands to celebrate your anniversary. You think of convent steps, the hurdles, the swimming hole, and your heart dies in you at a crow's cough.
The runner-up in last year's creative writing competition was Unfinished Business by Sheila Naish. Judge Vidar Harding described this poem as one of the most memorable in terms of content.
Unfinished Business by Sheila Naish. One pea and one maggot remain in the pod. One note from a madrigal hangs in the quad. On the hook hangs a spade that has not dug one clod. Unfinished Business. That letter, now faded, you started to write. That corner you rounded, then strolled out of sight. When no sorry, darling, could soften our fight. Unfinished business. My phone call, wrong number, so far yet so near. That message via neighbours I chose not to hear. That roadway not travelled, I missed out of fear. Unfinished business. One murmur, then silence. Our melody killed. Our future unwritten. Our dreams unfulfilled. Obituary column, then yesterday's wills. Unfinished business. Unfinished business. Un-biz.
At the end of the poem, Sheila left a postscript. He left on Christmas Eve 1971. An unforgettable date. The closing date for entries into this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition also lies well in the past.
but we'll be sure to bring you news of the winners just as soon as the judges announce their decision in the weeks to come. Now it's back to Dave Steele for the books of his life. Dave, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading?
Yeah, when I first started really reading for myself, obviously I read as a kid, not as much as kids read these days. I think that's one of the brilliant things about certainly being a parent, is seeing how much children these days love reading and how much it's a much more accessible and bigger thing than it was when I was a child. But when I really first started, you know, reading for myself, was probably in my teenage years, probably sort of 12, 13 upwards. I actually got into horror back then when I was a kid, and I read a lot of Stephen King and James Herbert, Clive Barker, those sort of things. But one of the first books I read, which just sort of made a comeback last year, which was made into a film, was Stephen King's It, which, you know, the killer clown side of things, you know, which obviously took a bit of a nasty twist last year. But it's storytelling and that, especially with It, I think the thing that appealed to me with that is that sort of, I love those films and those stories where you have a very stereotypical sort of group of friends, and it's generally the nerdy kids, and something happens, you know, things like Stand By Me, exactly, which was also written by Stephen King, which sort of appeals to me. And that was the first book that really got me interested in the storytelling aspect of things.
And a balloon? I've got red and green and yellow and blue. Do they float? Float? The clown's grin widened. Oh, yes, indeed they do. They float. And there's cotton candy?
George reached. The clown seized his arm, and George saw the clown's face change.
It, by Stephen King, narrated by Hayward Morse, is TB11196.
And is there a book that, on a rainy day, you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Reading for me these days, if it's not the poetry that I write, it's really with my son, my youngest son, Austin. We read every night, we do story times, and we do actually do them on Facebook Live. I don't know if any of you are aware of that, where you can do like a live feed, and he says to me every night, Daddy, can we do a Facebook Live? And we sit in his bed, he cuddles up in his pyjamas, and we have other people on my friends list that with their kids that will, you know, listen in, and we sit and read books by Julia Donaldson. For those of you that are not aware of Julia Donaldson, is she writes books like The Gruffalo, Gruffalo's Child, Room in a Broom, and there's a whole list of books, and they're all done in a poetic format, which for someone with sight loss like myself, because I've only got 5 degrees vision in my right eye left, I can't really see out my left eye, it's a lot easier. The words are always generally in sort of bigger text anyway, but because it's in poetic format, it allows me to be able to memorise the books in a way that I couldn't do with a normal book, and also makes them, obviously, because I can memorise them, easier for me to read for my son. So we do, you know, generally, his story time will probably be most nights 5 or 6 books. You know, it probably lasts about 45 minutes to an hour, his story time. We love reading Julia Donaldson, and I know she's very, very popular with a lot of the children.
A mouse took a stroll through the deep, dark wood. A fox saw the mouse, and the mouse looked good. Where are you going to, little brown mouse? Come and have lunch in my underground house. It's terribly kind of you, Fox, but no. I'm going to have lunch with a Gruffalo.
The Gruffalo, narrated by Stephanie Beattie, is TB17117. And like many of Julia Donaldson's other books, it's also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, a book that's very, very close to my heart, because the author is a friend of mine, and she actually, with her support, started me off, you know, with the whole process in the Stand By Me RP. It's Joanne Milne. She came to the world's attention about 3-4 years ago now, when she, at the age of about 40, was having a cochlear implant fitted. She's got Usher syndrome. and a video of her having a cochlear implant being switched on in a doctor's waiting room with a nurse repeating the days of the week and her hearing a clear voice for the first time went viral around the world. Very, very emotional, emotional clip. And she wrote a book about her life growing up as a deafblind person in Newcastle. And Usher syndrome is so closely related to retinitis pigmentosa. It really struck a chord with me when I read it. And also knowing Joanne personally and all the wonderful things that she's gone on to do since and inspire people around the world. She won awards on BBC last year for doing a documentary where she went out to India and supplied hearing aids for impoverished areas for lots of deaf children. And they did a mass switch on where all these children at the same time were hearing voices for the first time. It was an amazing program. But if you want a good read, Breaking the Silence by Joanne Milne is just an amazing and uplifting story of one girl's struggle to come to terms with and do amazing things with her dual impairment, vision and hearing loss.
I'm oblivious to the experiment they're carrying out behind me as I reach for a few discarded stickle bricks in front of the fireplace. First, they call my name. Joanne! Then, louder. Joanne! But of course, I don't turn round. Next, they clap. Again, nothing. Louder still, I don't so much as turn my head.
Colleen Prendergast, narrating Breaking the Silence by Jo Milne, which is TB 23782. It's also available in Braille and giant print. Dave Steele, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to Dave Steele. You can find out more about his work, including how to buy volumes of his poetry, by visiting his Facebook page, www.facebook.com/standbymerp, which is all one word. Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear your selections. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.